This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to part two of episode 23 with me being interviewed by Sam. So if you've just tuned into this one, go and listen to part one because otherwise you'd be really confused again. So we've split this up into two parts because quite a few people have said that when you have a 2.5 hour, 3 hour podcast, the file sizes are massive. So we split this into two. The first part is all about kind of the very long way around that I got into architecture. And then part two is all about kind of what parts of architecture I love and why I love them. And it's quite therapeutic talking about yourself. And it's been great to sit down and just really, really think about why I did. So a big kind of key message that came across in this is like mentors. There's kind of three people that stand out. There's Nicola Gerber, who is my tutor in Nottingham, who was amazing, and she was just fantastic. And then when I left my part one, I then worked with a guy called Carl Holloway, who ran his own studio, Holloway Foo, in Birmingham. And he was incredibly inspirational. And then when I came to Make, and someone I still see a lot, was kind of one of my bosses called Rob Hall. Again, I've realized that kind of through my life, it's all about kind of inspirational people who inspire you to kind of be way better than you are now. So yeah, I really, really hope you enjoy the podcast and listen to the end. And there is one small mistake that I say. I say there's a book called Flotsam and Jetsam. It's not, it's called Urban Flotsam. And it's amazing. It changed my life. So yeah, I really hope you enjoy it, and listen to the end to hear me talk more. Bye. So part two. So what I was going to say was the part one architecture course is your first year. You just need to get a pass, and it doesn't account to the rest of your grade. So as long as you get above 40%, you're through, you're into the second year, and your second and third year account to your overall grade. So you just wipe the slate clean. First year didn't exist as long as you pass.
Yeah.
And then second year is 30% of your mark is whatever you get in second year.
Yeah.
So first year I scraped through, got like 41% or something, had the best year ever. But creatively felt totally pointless.
I feel like they do set up degrees in that way though, because I don't think like, people have thought like, oh, they're all going to go and get pissed. Let's scrap the first year.
And then let them
just get drunk as hell. Yeah. And then the second and third year, they can actually do some work. Because I don't think it's actually like, I think it's almost in a way that first year, let's just set it up so we can feed them everything.
Yeah.
A drop of everything. They can fail at everything.
Yeah,
and that's fine.
Yeah.
And in the second and the third year, because obviously there's only 3 years for me, that's when like, you got to kind of start to understand it and put everything. Like the second year is when you start to understand things a little bit more and put it together and actually do research off your own back rather than being told where to research. And the third year is literally like, is a couple of briefs. You've got to go and do it all and be interested in it all and do it well.
Yeah, no, I totally, and I think like while people bemoan universities, it's just, what a waste of money. Like no one's making me drink lots of alcohol in the first year. Like that's my choice, right? Yeah. And it's like, so, but I architecture just seemed like this limitless course. Every direction I went in was like walking into a desert of information and like just like these amazing things, but like I could never find the end of anything. So I was like, well, right, well, I'm going to research concrete, and you just keep going and going and going, and then they'd be like, what about metal? And you're like, oh yeah, I'll go and look into metal. And do you even know anything about glass? And you're like, okay, I'll go into glass. And like, what about structural engineering? Like, we get structural engineers in. You're like, oh, okay, cool. Well, okay, what are your floor to ceiling heights? I'm like, what? Well, do you know like how do you hold a building up? Oh, I'm doing architecture. You don't need to know that. Well, you do, because everything about a building is structure, and you're trying to, and it's architecture, and you're like, okay, right. So how are you gonna do the structure? And I was like, oh, Jesus Christ, I don't know. Like, how are you gonna heat your building? oh, radiators, I don't know. And they're like, yeah, but they're like, you've just got a massive greenhouse with no way in it, and you've chosen a site in Italy in a greenhouse. And you're like, right, so it's going to be ridiculously hot. But it does look nice. Yeah, sure. As a sculpture, it's wonderful.
It is mental, isn't it? Because I've always thought, you know, to pin architecture down to something as simple as you possibly can, it's, in any way you look at it, it's a glorified way of putting a roof over someone's head. Whether it's making a building for like a multi-million, billion-pound building for a bank or whatever, yeah, or some sort of crazy mental building, or someone's house, all you're doing is putting over a roof over someone's head, yeah, either to work or to live, or to, like, some, yeah, other social kind of, or like interact, or, you know, any other thing that you want to use it for, whether that's sports or whatever, yeah, like there's loads of different things obviously that you can use it for, but you just, it's all about putting a roof over someone's head and obviously, like,
it's funny how it's changed, because like
the culture, like in where, what country you're putting in, you've obviously got to consider that, yeah, as well, haven't you, because, yeah, yeah, of the, yeah, heat, or, yeah, the lack of heat, or, yeah, whatever.
But it's funny you say that, like, it's funny how protective I now feel of architecture. When you say it's putting a roof over your head, I was like, no, it's not.
Like, no, it's not. It is, right? It surely
is. But it's like, I guess...
Is it not?
To me, architecture is not just buildings. Like, well, for me personally, I love landscaping as much as architecture.
Yeah.
I mean...
But the end goal is to put a roof over someone's head. I'm going to make you say it.
No. Like, the end goal is to just make someone experience something through architecture. That doesn't need to be a roof. I mean, there's an amazing Jewish war memorial in Berlin, and it's by an architect.
Okay.
And
yeah, I've seen that. That is... And the museum is mind-blowing. Yeah.
So bearing in mind, this is still in my third year, and I'm just starting to, like...
That room.
Embrace and enjoy architecture. And as you said, it's a roof. Like, that was kind of always my fault. It's just a roof for people to be in.
Yeah.
And it's really funny that you've described it like that, because that's the thing I was fighting against.
Yeah.
Was I didn't want to just design a room. I wanted to design something for people to experience.
Yeah, but as soon as you said that Jewish, I've kind of, yeah, realized that it actually
And it's
isn't.
Like, it's like... For me, the thing I cling on to is the idea that you can surprise and make people excited about going into a building. Mm-hmm. Like, so one of the things I struggle with at Make is that just the speed at which buildings go up. Mm-hmm. And the whole process is that you labor over every point to the point where you kind of lose a bit of perspective. And then it's only with hindsight after the building's finished and you look back a year later, you're like, ah, okay, I get it. And it's like, and you can't really surprise people on the scale of projects that we're doing. Like, it's in the press. It takes ages to get built, the scaffolding up. You slowly watch the structure come up, then the cladding, and then, yeah, it fills up. And then even then for a year, nobody's in it. And then by the time it's finished and the people are in there, like, yeah, yeah, we've seen it. It's like you lose that sense of surprise, which I loved.
Yeah.
But so a lot of, like, the buildings that I liked. So the very second year project that I really enjoyed, I created these, it's called the Cube Cave, and it was like, you had to design something about the history of Nottingham. I did these cubes that were completely black on the outside, yeah, and they would open, and it was literally like a spaceship. It seems funny now. It would open, you'd go in, and the idea was it would close, and it would only open again 5 minutes later, so you were stuck in this little room. And each one was modular on the inside, so some of them were all plasma screens, some of them had information, but the idea was like a cave, like, once you're in, you know, you had to wait, like, get out or whatever. But it was the idea that you could intrigue people. They didn't know what was in it.
Yeah.
They want to go in, and then you've got their undivided attention, a bit like a film, which is why I did like an animation for how it would open and close, all the engineering and stuff. And again, they were like, it is architecture, but it's like you're talking about the experience, but the actual architecture is very simple.
But surely that isn't that.
So I was kind of
isn't that the point though?
Well, I was more doing interactive displays. So they've always been a bit like.
But architecture, is it like the, yeah, architectural point is involved?
Well, again, this is that grey area, right? Like Jason Bruges does interactive architecture. So he does these interactive displays, and they're walls. Like my tutor would be like, that's a wall. It's just a wall that does something clever. Like if you turn the electricity off, it's just a wall. I was like, no, but it's got sensors on it. As people walk past, it's, ooh, and there's all these like cool, it follows their things. And they're like, yeah, but from an architectural point of view, mm-hmm, your elevation and your section are just a wall. I was like, all you're doing is photoshopping on. Like stuff, and I know you're enthusiastic and it would be amazing, but like in terms of actual architecture, like you need to design a thing that's a roof over your head, you know, yeah, like how do you heat and cool, protect that space, Like, how do you get in? Like, how do you move through it? What happens if there's a fire?
Yeah.
Like, how do you structurally support it? Do you want to show the structure?
Yeah.
Do you want to play with the structure? Do you want it to be unusual so people can't understand how it stands up? That's the playful side of it. So I always liked playing with that. So mega cantilevers, you know, so people, it would feel like it was going to fall down on them. So you'd like kind of create an emotional response by using structure and scale and color. Like, so I did this nightclub in first year called Silhouette, where only the lights were only the walls. And so everyone that walked past this wall was a silhouette, because obviously it would like blind you into just seeing the shapes and stuff. But like the branding of it was more important to me and that wall than the rest of the architecture. I was like, it's just a bar. There's a bar. You go in the bar. But no, this wall, like this wall is a silhouette, right? So at night, you're silhouetted against night. So I'd done all this photo and they were like, yeah. But it's like, turn all the electricity off or turn the lights off in the middle of the day. It's just four rooms. But I was like, no, but like it's an experience. So I kind of really struggled with this for ages because I didn't understand that you could play with structure, play with color and material.
Do you wish you could go back knowing what you do now?
No, I don't. Because I don't think I'd change anything if I could go back. I think like that pace, it just takes me I like to test stuff by doing everything and then the only way is the right way. It's a really stupid way to do it. But then, so like in third year, literally as I'm just being given that book, mm-hmm. We go to Berlin and I go to the Jewish War Museum, the Daniel Libeskind building.
Yeah.
And he uses floors off angle.
That room when
and
you're like
it's weird, but you're not 100% sure because the display cabinets are slight. You just feel a bit ill, like you're on a like, and then you see this horrible imagery whilst also being like slightly tilted on one side, and then you go into a room and it's really tall and there's little like light well at the top and you just...
That's unbelievable, that room, though, isn't it? The feeling that you get... Oh, because I was in there alone.
Yeah.
Everyone walked out when I walked in.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it's almost like a fire exit door, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I walked in and I was like, shit, this, it felt so daunting.
Yeah.
And so intimidating and so alone.
Yeah.
And like trapped in a box that... It was the first time, well, not the first time, but one of the times that I can really remember architecture affecting my emotion so much in a way to try and make me feel like a person back in that time.
Yeah.
I just blew my mind. And the funniest part of that building, we were walking around, it, and my girlfriend, and and we could hear what we thought was plates and cups like bashing around.
Yeah.
I was like, what's over there? She's like, oh, it's just a coffee shop. I can't be bothered with that. We won't go over there. I was like, no, but it's too... If that's plates and cups, they should have smashed them by now. And I said, I'm going to go and have a look. She's like, idiot. Why? It's a new coffee shop. Don't bother. I was like, oh, no, right, fine, whatever. I'm going down this way because if I don't, I'm going to regret it. Walk down it and it's that room with all the faces on it. I just look, oh my God, that's incredible. Like just the way that it, like the noise was manipulated. Because it was quite far away that I heard that.
Mm.
And the way that, you know, you thought it was something else, but actually it's something completely different.
Yeah.
Which just, you know what, I mean, you know the room
I'm in. Yeah. But so like the reason I was blown away by that building was there were interactive displays in there, things that kind of tricked your eye or whatever. Yeah. But actually my overwhelming feeling was these like really aggressive shards, you know, like these driving sharp lines that were like looming over you.
And walking through, you'd never think it was like a box shape. You know, like it's quite square. Is it quite square?
No, it's like zigzag. Like it's mental when you see it in plan. It's like... And then you go outside and you've got these looming, oppressive like black sculptures. I think you can get on top of. But so like you can kind of hear people having fun, but you're seeing these really like really... Yeah. Grand and overwhelming things. And I was like, so bearing in mind after like 3 years of just not getting it,
mm-hmm.
I was like, ah, what an amazing way to play with scale just by using concrete and inverting shapes and making stuff 20 times higher than a person. I kind of understood scale and concrete. And so I kind of just, I was like, suddenly all my projects just seemed so lame. Like they were just like, oh, I'm such a like little kid in like a tiny little world, and I've now just suddenly had my eyes open to it, and I felt so stupid. And then we went.
But isn't that quite an amazing way to learn that you've been taught, subconsciously, not subconsciously, but kind of in a indirect way, by an incredible architect that you've never even met before.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, amazing, he's taught you something through just going to one of his buildings.
So this kind of became the kind of... This became the first, like, architect. If I'd have done that in first year, I just would have been pissed the entire time, not cared. I wouldn't have paid any attention to it. I'd have been, like, so hungover. I was, but I was ready for it this time. And then we went to... Jeez, where did we go next? It was incredible. There was this Zaha Hadid. I think it's like the Wolfsburg Science Museum or something.
Yeah.
And it's this, like... I don't know if you're familiar with their buildings. They're kind of...
I know what they kind of look
they're like. They're all kind of on a 45 degree. They kind of convey motion.
Yeah.
It looks like the whole building's racing to zoom off the site or whatever. But the kind of geometry, you're like, there's not a single straight line on it. It's like everything's curved and it's all made out of concrete. And you've got people skateboarding up the inside and they're jumping off everywhere. And you go in and like the handrails and walkways like zoom around and like... it was irrelevant what was in there. I was just like, oh my God, like how does the handrails in the concrete and there's lights in the concrete. And I was like, and all the windows are like weird shapes. They're like every piece of geometry tied in with everything else. And I was like, there's not like, so going from an incredibly angular, aggressive building to an incredibly like smooth moving building. I was like, this concrete's amazing. This is amazing. And I actually bought a book about concrete. Nerd. and then we went to...
Have you still got it?
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah, it's amazing. I can't remember what it's called though. And then we went to Barcelona, and I went to the Guggenheim in Bilbao. Yeah. Bilbao, how do you say it? It's like a Frank Gehry one, or Frank Gehry. Yeah. Anyway, he does these crazy buildings. They're like he's kind of pushing the forefront of 3D technology. So he. I'm doing him a massive injustice, but he scrunches up paper, basically, creates these crazy shapes and then goes, right, that's our building. And then he has this incredible, I'm massively doing him injustice. He does amazing stuff, but he then builds all those wavy shapes through 3D and has all the metal fabricators. Actually, they don't make anything. Everything's done by machine. And then it all fits together like a massive Lego set. And it's this wavy building and I looked at it and it was just one massive sculpture with an art gallery in.
Yeah.
It's mental. It didn't have a roof. It does, but it's like the roofs, the walls, the sides. There's a wave at the front, which doesn't have anything to do with the building. It just looks cool. And then it flows over and you're like, everything's this weird swooping shape and the structure's mental. Like you have no idea how it stands up. So it's like concrete angular, like concrete smooth, metal, amazing. And then there's this the Casa de Musica in OMA's one in Porto. So we did this like cross Germany to like Spain across into Portugal trip. And it's this massive, do you watch Red Dwarf? You know Crichton, the robot head.
Yeah.
Imagine Crichton's head made out of concrete and it looks like a meteorite. Like if you imagine like Porto, everything's 10 meters high and this is 100 meter high building. It looks like a meteorite. It's
rustic-y.
A meteorite just gone poof, right in the middle of the city. And the actual landscaping looks like a shockwave. So it looks like it's been dropped there and the landscaping goes whoa, as if it's like punched its way into the ground.
Oh my God.
And it's this mental shape. Like it's a huge opera hall in the middle, but it goes, and I was just like, this is absolutely incredible. This is amazing. I came back and then my tutor, Nicola, was just like, what do you want to do? And I was like, well, I love doing exercise. I just got into exercise, running and cycling and stuff. So I filmed myself sideways with a camera, slowed it down and did stop motion. So I did like 20 frames or 15 frames a second and drew a stick man on me. And then slowly in video in Premiere Pro, like had me swimming or running on a treadmill sideways. And then I would merge the picture out of me. And then I'd just have a stick man running, which was like me running. And then I overlaid those and like, I was like, I want to do a sculpture based on someone running. And they were like, running's boring. Choose like something more dramatic. So I love free running. Like, do you remember free running used to be really popular and cool?
Yeah. Were you one of them people?
I used to love, I never did it, but like, I love climbing stuff. and it felt like this sense of freedom, right? You just run over the city. The city's yours. Your city's your playground. So that genuinely became my like, well, I love free running. Free running, it would like skateboarding, like someone do a skateboard park. That's how cool it felt to me. Mm-hmm. Everyone else is doing like a museum or a port for boats with restaurants and galleries in. And then there's me, like total curveball doing free running. And I've got these amazing evocative images of people like diving over buildings and stuff. And I learned Photoshop and, you know, you merge.
It's funny how you didn't teach yourself a lesson going to all those places in Europe and seeing how you can take a museum and do it in such a different way.
Yeah.
But yet at the same time, you're like, nah, fuck that. I'm just going to do something.
But like, I didn't understand the museum because like above being like Zaha's known, right, for her museums to be more interesting than the stuff in it.
Yeah.
So you go to the museum as a sculpture.
Yeah, yeah,
just to see her building.
Yeah.
And like the stuff in it is like, well, yeah, there's a painting there, but like, look at this building. Like it's absolutely incredible. So she's done these, honestly, they're absolutely gorgeous. But the kind of the critique of them is that, well, you're kind of overwhelming what's in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So to me, a museum, like if you're going to design a true museum, be a white room with lights on, and it would be these grand like entrance ways, but actually the art should speak for itself. The room should be very quiet. But I wanted to do something cool, right? I wanted to do something cool. So I did free running. And then I did all those stop motion things of people doing flips and jumps across tables. And then like I did a building where like every second of someone doing a table vault, their body crumping together and we're going out wide again. I did like concrete sculptures. So like if you imagine the building was like 120 meters long and it had all this stuff on. It was like a concrete, it was like a playground basically. It didn't have any windows in. It was just this massive 100 meter long, incredible concrete sculpture. And I got like one of the highest marks in the year for it because I was so like, I'd done these amazing renders and like I put concrete on everything, but then put sprays like graffiti all over it in Photoshop. So it looked like this really run down, but spectacularly huge. It was like 50 meters high in the middle and it went along and it was like this idea of motion and people could run and climb over it and it had loads of different things going on inside it. But it was just concrete.
Yeah.
And I loved it. And I was like, oh, okay, maybe I can do this. And I got a really high mark that year. And like, it, like everyone loved my project. And I got like pretty much the highest mark in my unit. I was like, oh, I think I've got it. And then
a little pat on the back.
Went to Bailey Garner in Birmingham. That was my first summer placement.
Mm-hmm. Have you talking about that? Your
that was boring. that was where I really hit the ground. Blueprint's like one of the best architecture magazines in the country.
Blueprint's like well known.
And they put my work in it. So really? Like in the summer,
that's cool.
I was one of two people chosen from our university to have our work put in Blueprint.
Nice.
So I remember being on holiday and getting the phone call from the Blueprint editor going, oh, like my tutor going, your work's in Blueprint. And I was like, I've made it, like finally, like feel vindicated. And then and then went to work in like Birmingham in like a multidisciplinary practice doing social housing. And the bump that I hit the ground with, which I think a lot of people feel, is you're a real big deal at uni. Like you live, breathe, do architecture. And then like, yeah, we just need to do the fire door rating chart. Like we need to do a door schedule. You're like, no, I don't think you understand. My work was in Blueprint. and they're like, yeah, great, great. You know, we do need you to do the, just, can you just print the drawings out and fold them? What? Yeah, no, there's like 150 drawings. You've just got the day, just three boots. Oh, Jesus Christ. I remember thinking, oh, this is crap. But then you're a nobody. Like, you're just like, you've just learnt to drive and then you want to drive like an articulated lorry or something. Like, just build yourself up to it. So,
have you heard of I highly doubt you would have, but a graphic designer called Paula Scher. She tends to, try and do, I know this is doing her a massive disjustice, but she almost tries to do as little graphic design as possible, which is almost a credit to her work anyway, because there was, I can't remember what city it was in was it Pennsylvania or something in America, somewhere anyway, but a city that was kind of like all surrounded by going through through a tunnel or like a bridge or something to actually get into the inner city. And they were asking her to come up with a new, like a badge to, or an emblem to brand the city. And she actually turned around and like, and you said, look, I'm not going to design you a logo. I'm not going to do it at all. And she, what she saw was to actually brand or like use these tunnels as a way to brand the city and bring museum or like not a museum, but you turn it into like an almost exhibition space or an art space for people to use and change every month. And she just came up with a slideshow that wasn't a slideshow at all. It was just different renders of this tunnel would be just changed
Wicked.
Each time. And they totally like I think I remember it right. She was giving the presentation the whole time. Everyone was silent, and she's like, "Oh shit, it's gone pretty badly." Yeah. Crap. And they loved it, and they did it. I think they did it anyway. But yeah, it's just an amazing way of flipping graphic design between architecture, because obviously a lot of the science are taken into graphic design. But I think you'd like a lot of the stuff she does, because she does a lot of her and obviously a lot of other people. Mm. She tends to do a lot of super graphics stuff. So applying stuff to buildings and things like that are really quite interesting. Have you seen the super graphics book in the thing done by people called Unit? I'll show you it tomorrow. It's really...
But what's, I think is the best thing about architecture then, the course, is that not only were you learning structures, attempting to learn how to heat and cool a building. Originally, I made the structure of this thing out of timber, and I went to structure engineer, and like the look of total just like, what? That's the dumbest thing I've ever seen. Like his just total look of disappointment. They're like, bloody architects. But like on top of that, I'd learned video editing. Like I did a music video for like these like stop-go animation things, and then you do these books, right? Like, so I did these professional books. Like I literally overwhelmed my tutors with just like information, you know, like books and graphics, and like I'd done like, you know, I obsessed over like Photoshop, text font, like I used InDesign, Premiere Pro, After Effects. Like I felt like a little like production house basically. And I loved it. Like I loved like being able to flip between each one. I guess that's kind of, again, the ethos of the podcast is like, they're all things that I've touched on in the past, you know, like I love films. I love that idea of being able to surprise people. Like one of the buildings in Germany went to, you went down a pitch black corridor, turned again down a corridor, and the corridor got super narrow, so there's a handrail either side, so you knew what you were holding on to, and it led you into a totally dark room, and then it would show this incredibly kind of like weird film. But it was just the way that they'd manipulated you, so like you were so hyper aware of your surroundings. But I loved all that, and then to suddenly go into something that I didn't feel, again, I was like, oh, I'm doing something for someone else again now.
Yeah,
like to go into a job where, do you know what it was? I'm thinking back to it, like it was just that the people there just didn't really care about the project they were on. They needed work.
Yeah.
They wanted a job.
Yeah.
And they were doing it. And like, what was interesting was like a lesson in like CAD standards is that you do these setting out drawings. So like grid drawings, which every other drawing is based off a grid drawing. So that grid becomes like your master plan for all the other drawings. So like if you're drawing walls across different levels, this grid is like, the grid sits behind every one of your drawings, and that grid is the center line of every wall.
Yeah.
So you always know how a wall lines up from floor to floor without having to like open every drawing and reference in, because you always know that the kind of glazing support sits exactly on that grid. Like it doesn't sit a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right. It's bang, its center line is on that. Yeah. So it's center line of all these things. And then that's how you kind of coordinate massive amounts of information, is by having this kind of background of information that you always reference.
So yeah, that makes sense. Makes some sense that I didn't actually know before. That's good. Because it, like drawings of like, say if you were designing a really tall building, I always wondered how like you were saying, I always wondered what you just said, but never really understood it, or even understood how to ask the question. Exactly. Of like, what the hell is going on? Like,
it's just a wall sits in a wall sits in a wall, but like everything has to line up. So you start to learn how you lay out like your plans in the middle of a drawing, and then your elevations are drawn each side of the plan. So you just draw lines off the plan, and that forms the walls of your elevation, like the sides of the building.
Yeah.
And then you build up this kind of diagram of information.
Yeah. Because I always wondered, seeing big tall buildings going up around in London, you always see the, am I right in saying it's the lift shaft that goes up first?
Yeah.
And then everything gets built around it. So I always wondered whether that would be the first thing that you would decide where to go.
Yeah.
Or like you kind of like design the shape of the building.
Yeah.
Then it's like, right, where do the lifts go?
Yeah.
Or the stairs go?
Yeah.
And then everything goes around that.
Yeah, it's really funny. It seems like such a fundamental question that I'd never even thought that you would even, that anyone would even contemplate why you wouldn't put that in the middle of the building. But it makes total, like...
But is that right?
Yeah. So we're doing a tall building at the moment, and...
But I guess I only really guess that because I've got you.
Well, what you're referencing, you're talking about the core at the middle of the building, which is essentially the spine of the building. So, like, you're building a climbing frame up in the air. You need something to anchor it on, don't you? So you build this, like... It's usually built out of concrete, and it's called slip forming. And the way they do that is they just... Like, imagine a bucket with no top on, and you fill the bucket up, then you move the bucket up, fill it with more sand, move the bucket, and you just keep going up and up and up, and like you just keep slipping that bucket up and up and up.
And that's where normally the crane sits.
Yeah, yeah. So what they can do is the crane goes up, this little sleeve goes up the crane, it splits the crane, another like a block comes up, slides into the crane gets taller, the slides up, lifts the crane up in two pieces, slots another bit of the crane in, and the crane just kind of gets higher and higher.
So this kind of blows my mind a little bit in the way that the Shard was built then, because they went down, and no, they went up in the rate that they went down.
It's called up top-down construction. So what it means is that the hardest part about sites about the Shard is that it's like literally how do you get rid of the waste? Like how do you bring steel into the site? Like it's such a constrained site. So by building the ground floor...
Did you see that BBC documentary on it?
No. Is that like a megastructures thing or something?
I think so. It's just a BBC thing about how they built it. And that's just how I know that they went down as well as they went up, but, and then it flooded and they were... like fucked. And then they had to like sort out the bottom before they could go any further up. But they were going higher quicker than they could go down because they flooded, and then they had to stop going up, which made them lose money. And then they had to sort out the bottom to then go further up as well.
It's quite a gamble. I mean, everything about construction is a calculated gamble, isn't it? The idea is that if you imagine being on site every day costs you £1 million, just for argument's sake, every day that you can save is a massive saving. So if you can offset the complication of having two construction crews, one going up, one going down. And the reason, like, for example, on the building that we're working on, if it goes ahead, is that what they might do is to build the basement, they might backfill the basement full of soil to stop the sides falling in and then dig down, build another basement level, and then build the structure up and then take all the soil out. So it's because essentially, if you imagine like the basement, imagine soil is water, and like your perimeter wall is stopping all that water just flooding flooding your basement, but that water is incredibly heavy, and at the moment you've got steel coming like beams going from the edge, the kind of the edge of the bath coming into the middle, and that's the core, that spine running up is like bridging, bracing kind of sides, the second you take the core out or take any of those beams out, suddenly the whole thing's going to flop in and it's going to fill up with soil. So it's incredibly dangerous and hard work doing a basement. So like 25-30% of your budget will just be the basement, and then no matter how tall the building is, and it's like some projects go ahead without full funding. And they just build the basement, assuming that if the longer they wait, the market will change or whatever. Like, especially the projects we're working on in London, they're so big. They take so much time. Economic instability plays like a massive part. So, for example, I won't say the name of the project in case this isn't as an obvious information, but during the recession, we worked in a building that actually meant a lot of people lose a lot of money in recessions. But if you have lots of money, it's a brilliant time to buy stuff because everyone's desperate for work. So they managed to get the steel for the building at like a ridiculously low price. They just like how many tons of steel is in the building. They use our 3D model. They work out how many pieces of steel. Let's say 1 million tons. I don't know, 500,000 tons. They then go to steel manufacturing in like, you know, Mexico or something and say, look, we need 500,000 tons of steel. They've got nowhere to sell their steel to. Essentially, they're making no money. And they're like, oh, we'll give it to you for like 50% of the current market rate because we've no one's building. We're in a recession. And they're like, ah, yeah, we don't need it now. We need it in 3 years' time when we actually get around to using it. But sign here and we'll give you the money now. Something that. And then in 3 years' time, they suddenly have this ridiculously cheap steel. So a lot of people will purchase things in a recession because people are desperate for work. So they're kind of throwing a lifeline to people. They're also getting a fantastic deal. But I think the thing is, like, if it's your job to save money, like if your job is to work in a 1,000-person company and your sole job is like your bonus is how much 10% of the money you can save on a project, that's your job. Like that's what people's job. It's called value engineering on a project. So let's say, for example, let me give you a really simple example. A skyscraper, 40-story skyscraper. We design it, but we have no idea how much it's going to cost. We're just drawing lines on a page, right? And we do 3D models and everything. And then you get a...
Do you have to... Is it your responsibility to... Because there's structural engineers that figure out like your crazy design and they actually make it... they make it buildable. And, you know, structurally sound and all that kind of thing. Is there... is there separate people involved that, or a separate company, or is there like sometimes in-house people that will figure out the cost of the building?
Yeah.
For the client itself.
Yeah. So if you imagine everything is a risk on a big project, it's it's such a risky business to get into. And if you imagine, let's say you've got a £200 million skyscraper.
Yeah.
An architect's fee might be 3%, 4%, 5% of that.
Yeah.
That's so over the duration of the construction project. So once you've got planning permission, they go, right, we're going to build this project. You agree on a cost of £200 million. If you think of the architect's fee of £200 million, it's so small. And then inside of that, like 0.1% of the fee might be for someone to work out the cost of something.
Yeah.
And then they can work out a way to save even more money. Like, whilst to that person, he's getting paid hundreds of thousands of pounds to just for 5 years sit on a project and work out how much money to save over the lifespan of the project. But there's loads of projects that we design a building. The structural engineer goes, the structure's too complicated. Make that simpler.
Yeah.
That's his job, to make it simpler and cheaper for the client. And you're like, whoa, what you're suggesting makes our building boring. And then the quantity surveyor who just like tells you how much it costs is like, no, he's right. You could save quite a lot of money here. You've got two people arguing against saving it. And then it's your job to try and explain to the client, you could save money, but it will look worse.
Yeah.
And then the client decides whether he cares about how it looks.
Yeah.
And whether he wants to save the money.
Oh my God.
So, but do you know what? As I get further and further on in these bigger projects, and you are in those meetings and you understand everyone's point of view, it makes those decisions so much more understandable.
Yeah.
It's when you're just doing CAD work and the only thing you hear is, oh, we're changing the whole design to make it cheaper. You're like, oh, what?
Yeah.
I mean, luckily that hasn't happened to me because, you know, we just worked on really prestigious projects at Make, but I know during the recession.
I can't imagine. I imagine that sometimes there must be projects out there where you're doing all the talking between people because certain people won't talk to each other.
Yeah.
And that must be absolutely chaotic.
Do you know what I find fascinating is that that's a skill. That is a massive skill because you think...
Do you learn any of that? Like, do they encourage learning any of that or somehow learning any of that at university, like the managing of people and stuff?
I think you just... Well, you kind of learn through osmosis just by watching other people do things. But... so what was I going to say? Yeah, so I was going to say about personalities, and then I'll get on to working in groups because I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. And probably why I got a job here actually was if you imagine you've got a massive developer, one of the biggest developers in the country, and then you've got Make or Foster's or Richard Rogers or OMA, biggest architecture practice in the country.
Yeah,
you just think when those two things get together that they're just two huge corporations, they're huge companies, they'll just work together. But actually it all comes down to a room with like two or three people in. And if you piss them off, they're just not going to work with you.
Yeah.
And I find that like a £200 million building can rest on you being a dick in a meeting or not.
Yeah.
Like if you think like at the beginning, it's so fragile.
Yeah.
You're doing kind of work for free, but not for free. You know, you may do a competition for like £10,000 or you might win it.
Yeah.
And then there's a little bit like, oh, we've got this plot of land. Like, what can we do with it?
Yeah.
Like, well, you could put a skyscraper, you could put a hotel, you could put a restaurant. they would decide that, but they would want to know like, okay, well, we think we can put a tall building on there. Like, how tall can it be?
Yeah.
But it's like, if you just had to go on holiday for a week and just didn't check your emails for a week and didn't tell anyone, then they may not go with you again. They may just go, well, you're too unreliable. Or you decide to, no, I'm going to stand my ground. No, this is the design you're having. They're like, right, we're going to send their architects. You're like...
Well, it's even more fickle with that. That's exactly how it is in graphic design, but... Yeah.
Oh, it's way more extreme in graphic design, I would say, that fickleness.
It's so cutthroat. Like, it may not be, like... It could be a couple of minutes. Well, not minutes, that's rubbish. But, you know, hours. If you, like... So if you miss a print run or something like that, you're out. It's just, I notice how cutthroat it is in architecture with, like, you have to, you know, protecting and looking after the people, rightly so.
Mm.
And rightly so in any job like this, where you have to look up and you're doing work for them. But
But what I like, I always like, I think I sometimes like talk about.
It's even some, sorry, it's like even sometimes with your, like mates and stuff, when you say to them, like, oh yeah, yeah, like build a website or whatever, or do some branding for someone. Yeah. And you know, like, and things suddenly get in your reputation yourself, even though, because sometimes work a lot of the time can come from friends, even more so with graphic design, and your reputation is ditched between friends, and that goes to their friends and then their friends, their parents, their friends, and they know like companies or whatever that need graphic design, and then you just, you know, you're not, that's ever happened to me, like, you know,
yeah,
but like,
no.
Your reputation is so, and it's the same again, and I always, with my lecturers back in Portsmouth, it's funny, I have a running joke of relating graphic design back to plumbing, and there is so many similarities. It's
reputation, I guess.
Well, yeah, it is, and it's all about reputation. And the, I'd say the reputation, I know this is more about architecture, but the, your reputation in graphic design and plumbing is so fragile that you just have to nurture that thing so much.
Yeah.
But I guess as much as you almost like, from what I've seen in architecture, it's more about making sure that you have the right personality that to the, in it, because you're representing a company, aren't you? So it's,
well, it's funny, when I was when I did my part two, and when I applied to Make, I told,
basically, just don't be a dick, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Just, it's amazing how far that gets you. Yeah. Just, if you're happy, enthusiastic, work hard, and not a dick. Like, those are like great career advice, right?
Someone,
there, isn't it?
So a lecturer told me that, and I was at an awards ceremony, and it was a lecturer that left in the second year, and we were talking about design and stuff, and a little bit drunk, whatever. And Jesus said, "The most important thing is just not to be a dick."
Yeah.
Like, it's like you know what to do now. You know, you know how to be a graphic designer. You know how to work it. Just be a nice person. Mm. Don't be one of those person and be a dick, because it's just, it'll ruin you. And
Hashtag don't be a dick. What we said
but
there.
It just it stuck. It, yeah.
But what's funny is like
me, stuck with me.
You've worked at Make now, so you're just as part of this statement as everyone. But this idea that Make, the people at Make, have a certain personality type, because we're just a really nice company to work at. And I think when I was about, when I told someone I got a job offer at Make, my tutor was like, she used to work in recruitment and was like, you'd fit right in at Make. That doesn't surprise me at all. Like, she knew me. Mm-hmm. And I think if you know what you were saying,
because I don't know, I don't really, I can't, as much as I know a lot of graphic design studios and how big they are, I've never really understood how big Make is.
Are we big?
I don't know.
In the architecture world, we're quite big. I think we're probably in the top, like, 5 or 6 or something. In
really?
Terms of size, yeah. In the UK, yeah.
Holy smokes.
There's massive ones. I mean, or maybe, we're definitely in the top 10.
But that's cool.
But it's like, I guess, you know, you're saying about it being fickle.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of Make's selling points are, they're very fragile to maintain.
Yeah.
And we've worked really hard on them.
Yeah.
And they are so
fragile. It does
seem
to have an amazing reputation.
Yeah, but like, so, like, we don't say we have a house style, but in the same way we don't have job titles inside a Make, there are obviously invisible job roles. There has to be for a project. Like, as well, you can't work with the master developer unless you say exactly who's the job architect, who's the project architect, who's the... You have to assign those roles inside. But the point is, like, you have to operate in that role to be that role. You don't just get given it. So in the same way we don't have a house style, we do. It's just, it's flexible.
Yeah.
Like, we will work with a client to produce amazing architecture that is, obviously we have things that we like the look of.
And everyone sees everyone's projects.
Exactly. So,
as much as,
you know, especially when the bigger the projects get, the fewer they are, the more they stand out. And it's like, you can say you don't have a house style, but then you've done 4 mega projects and they're like 4 very distinct shapes.
Yeah.
Suddenly everything kind of fits between those boundaries, right?
Yeah.
Suddenly, like, we start to use more stainless steel and glass and solidity and stuff. And it's like, but they're like, they're not unusual in the architecture profession. Like, there are other amazing architecture practices. I guess we're, it's just, I feel at Make, it's even being low down or like working my way up, but that I feel like I have a voice inside of Make, which I like. But again, like, warring against it at the beginning, like, I didn't understand big projects. Like, I went from being my own boss, working in little teams or on my own, to suddenly being in the biggest project that Make had ever done.
Yeah.
And I was like, and not knowing the history of the project, not going to the client meetings, and like, this was the reality. Like, oh, again, because I felt like it wasn't, I wasn't listened to. It was like, but you were just producing work at a very high rate, very, very hard work, very like long hours.
Yeah.
But you don't understand how much you're learning when you're under stress. Like, it's just like, oh, just blindly throwing the tracks down in front of the train. Like, oh, Jesus Christ.
You've seen that all, I think.
Yeah.
So I was imagining it.
Yeah. And then you look back and you think, Jesus Christ, that was amazing that, you know, you're able to operate at that capacity. Like, yeah. That's not normal to,
yeah.
Normally I do whatever I want to do whenever I want to do it. And to suddenly be forced to work within very tight boundaries. And then you suddenly understand why they're there. And you're like, oh, I get it now. And it's like, but again, it was like the tutoring, like university, like it took me a long time to fight against it. And then to suddenly go, Jonas, it's actually really good. Like, I kind of get it now. Because, again, you know, going back to teams and working in teams, such a good point. Like, if you can't work in a team, you're going to hate working in a big practice.
Yeah.
I think as long as you, like, some people are just natural born leaders and they don't work well in a team. And that's fine. I think some people, they're incredibly clever.
Yeah.
But they may not be able to just, like, convey that.
Yeah.
Because essentially, like, you can be the best architect in the world, but if you suddenly need to do three architects' jobs, you need to, like,
delegate
that work to other people. And suddenly the process of having to explain to other people, not just how they would do it, but how you want it done.
Yeah.
Especially on a practice of this scale, when you're, especially with graphics, you're trying to do graphic styles across a whole practice.
Yeah.
You then have to like literally give bullet point weight, and you want it to be fun and enjoyable for everyone to do, but it's like, it's hard. And it's the same with architecture. It's like, I don't have time to mess around helping you. I just want to get on doing it myself. But essentially, like, you have to be good at that to work. And I'm just starting to learn that it's hard.
Yeah.
But it's like a different skill. Like, you can suddenly achieve so much more than you can on your own.
Yeah.
But it's not exactly how you would have done it. But eventually you start to trust the people around you that while it's not exactly how you would have done it, it's actually just as good. It's just not exactly you.
Yeah.
You have to kind of give up that like maximum control thing, which you can't. I'm not being an arrogant dickhead. I'm just saying, like, at uni, you have to believe in yourself so totally to present in front of 50 people.
Yeah, exactly.
This is my project. This, I'm pinning all my university hopes on this project. Like, you have to like build up a certain like tolerance of like arrogance, I guess. But so I only worked on my own in part one, and then you do a year out. So you have to do a part one, which is 3 years, or four, and then you do a year out, and then you do another 2 years back at university, and then that's your part two.
Yeah.
And then you have to do a master's or a degree or whatever they want to call it. It's like a law conversion at the end.
And this is where what I mean by that you can only call yourself an architect after that, can't you? And it's the only industry within the creative side of things that is protected in that way, which I think is amazing.
It's for good reason as well, because essentially you could design a building that could kill someone. Like, you could quite easily design a building that falls down. And once you suddenly start to put those security gates in place to stop that from happening, actually you have to go fully up the chain of command. You know, you can't like...
Yeah, because it's not like I'm going to design a book.
You have to be legally responsible for something. Otherwise, you know, like me and you could design a house, someone, it falls down. You're like, whoa, well, I didn't tell them to build like that. Like, you know.
But don't you have to...
You have to put some safeguards in place, don't you?
Isn't there... Do you decide on how long... Is it
you're
in
responsible
your contract? No, how do you put that in a contract with that building, or open to discussion?
No, that's
how long you look after that building.
That's a really, really good point.
Built.
You can, there's legally two different options. We were just talking about it. So, like, people in the office doing their part three, which is your, you know, your law bit at the end, they're suddenly the most knowledgeable people and they remember all these things because. It's called like a deed, and it's either underhand and or overhand. I can't remember what it is, but there's 6 years or 12 years. Mm-hmm. So, in the same way
do you get paid to look after it as well? Or
no,
is it...
you have to pay for PI insurance. The same way you have a car, you have to insure your car while it's on the road.
Yeah.
Imagine if you had a car and you had to insure it for 6 years.
Yeah.
And someone else is driving it, basically.
But what if it's only small things? Like, what?
No, everything. Well, it's all contractual. Like, you can do...
But like, so the difference between like... you've built a building and a couple of rooms isn't working, they want to reconfigure it, but it's kind of almost, it's not your fault, but you know, it just didn't work for the way that they were operating. So whole thing had to be redesigned. Do you get paid then for that? Or is that something that you negotiate to then try and figure out? I guess I'm just trying to figure out what happens when a building's done. What happens with that? Is there a certain caretaker role for a
building to be done? It's called practical completion. It's practically complete. It's not perfect. A building's never perfect.
No, of course.
It's practically, but it's an interesting.
So it's almost like an architecture caretaker role of that building, like looking after it as an architect. Yeah,
but it's funny because any architects will understand that it's a very specific wording. It's practically complete. But the point is you have to sign it with the client that you're both happy it's done.
Yeah.
And then following on from that, if they want to change the design, they can go to any architect or they can come to you. They'll probably come to you because you're familiar with the building. And sometimes you just won't have a very good relationship with the client at the end.
Yeah.
I was talking to someone, and if you think about dentists, doctors, architects, lawyers, you go to lawyers and doctors in a point of total desperation. Uh-huh. Like you go to them for that last bit of help. Mm-hmm. And it's a point of pessimism, whereas you go to an architect in a state of optimism, like, I've got £500,000, I'm going to do a house. And they're like, whoa, calm down, right? So if it's an extension, 20% that goes to VAT, and they're like, oh. And our fees are typically around 10 to 15%, depending on how complicated it is. So you've actually only got 65% of what you just talked about. And you're like, oh, have I done really bad maths? No, 65%. And they're like, oh, yeah. And then actually, you know, what do you want? Oh, I want a 5-story extension. Oh, well, okay, I'll design that. Okay, that's going to cost £1 million. Oh, what can I get for 300, like 600 and whatever money I've got? And they're like, well, we can give you this. I don't want that though. Okay, fine, but I want these lights in it. Well, you only got £10,000 to fit out the whole thing. And they're like, oh. And then they have to live in a building site for the next year and a half. And then they find a manhole cover in their back garden and you have to pay an extra £20,000 to have it moved. And that knocks on an extra 6 weeks. And you're like, it's like, even as an architect, the sheer complicated and like how long it goes on for, it's surprising. I've just done up my own house and that's a really important thing for an architect to do because it suddenly makes you so conscious of money, time, how well you explain to builders.
I bet those things that you're going through, I bet you're like, if you knew that at uni, you'd be like, oh, Jesus.
Yeah. Well, as well, like you don't care at uni. You want to do the most amazing, crazy building. You don't care about the law side of it. Yeah. But then when you do it yourself, you're like, yeah, I really should have paid more attention to the law side of things. So for example, they call it defects liability period. So even when you've signed off the building, old Gary the builder could have just fudged the wall together, just held it up until he came in the room, leaning against it. Yeah, so we're done. Can you just sign here? Yeah, we're all good. Run away. And the next day it all falls down. That would totally happen.
But so, they have insurance as well.
They sign up to a defects liability period where you say the building was £100,000, the extension or whatever. You would hold back £5,000.
Yeah.
And then I can't remember exactly. It depends on contracts and I'm probably getting it wrong, but for a year, so for a full season, timber buildings or anything we render or plaster, anything, wet plaster, wet plaster in our living room is still drying after 6 months. It dries to a certain level in winter and then in the summer, the whole house heats up and suddenly the plaster just shrinks just that little bit more and it's called day joint. So in a day, the guys may do half a room. They come back the next day, they carry on plastering. And that point where they overlap, you'll get a little, a tiny little hairline crack that goes at the wall. And then if you've got plasterboard walls touching a wall, just the very tip of where it meets the ceiling, if the door slams a lot, is cracked.
Yeah.
Or suddenly, we've got decking outside in our garden.
Yeah.
And in the heat of the summer, it's like a full sun trap. It was laid in winter.
Yeah.
It's pressure treated. I checked it all. But it's shrinking. I can suddenly see between them. And I was like, I couldn't see that in winter. And they're like, well, it'll expand again in winter. So, but there's so many little things. And it's just like, that's not really what I wanted to do when I signed up to my Zaha and crazy buildings thing. But I now kind of enjoy that side more. Whereas before it was just blind panic. You're legally responsible for a building for 6 years. I have PI insurance. Oh my God. You suddenly check every drawing 10 times when you're doing setting out. On Broadgate, you're doing, just the roof alone was 20 million quid. So I was fresh out of uni. Just the structure and cladding was 20 million quid. And you're like, doesn't anyone else? No, Ben, you're working with the contractors. It's fine. But what, are you confident, Ben? Well, you know, as confident as I can be. And then, like, you see this massive 100-meter-high crane, like one of five in the country, raising up like a piece of steel. It's like, this is the weight of an articulated lorry. And it's like the key bit of all the structure. And you're like, oh, shit. That's right. It's in. Or if, you know, they're craning up like a generator or something up on the roof, you're like, oh, God, I hope that. Or I did all the waterproofing. We had that. It's called like a, you design for the worst case scenario, right?
Yeah.
So you design it not for normal rain, but a 1 in 100 year storm. So they go back 100 years and find out the worst storm they've ever had. And then you design it for that rain load. And I'm like, well, how much rain's that? And you have to work out how much rain is on the roof and if the structure can take a swimming pool of water on the roof.
My God.
And then we had that 100 year storm. Like we had the worst winter ever when they were designing it and it didn't leak. I was like, thank the Lord. Oh my God. So,
but that's what I was saying about that's the thing when you know it's a job or a career that you found one that you like because you've got to a headache, but it's like it's not that you've just stumbled your way through the headache, you've actually enjoyed the headache.
Yeah, have I enjoyed it? It's interesting. It's like it's like I never feel like I'm getting any closer.
Yeah, but now, like,
everything.
It's, I guess, after the headache that you realise that was actually a lot of fun to do and you've learned something from it.
I described someone like doing a marathon, like the last 6 miles of marathon are hard, but then when you finish, you're like, oh, it's amazing.
Because when you're in it, you're just like, this is the worst thing ever. I hate it. And I hate being in the headache. I find it really difficult. But you just keep going. It's the keep going that you know when you can get through it.
Well, it's like understanding that creative process that it's got to get really bad. You've got to smash everything to the floor in sheer rage and then build it all back up again. And it's better the next time you do it. But, you know, like you've just, I don't know. It's that creative process, which is just, I find when things go well, it's an amazing feeling. It's like sometimes like when I presented my third year work, like it was the first time in 3 years, like, due to like some weird timing thing, like everyone's tutorials stopped, mine overran into lunch and I had a load of cool stuff I wanted to show and people came over, so I ended up having like 30 people sat behind my tutors. There's three tutors and then like loads of my colleagues and other people from other units came over and I presented my work and they were like at the end, wow, you'd like, I can tell you're incredible. That's a fantastic project. And that's like one of the best feelings after like running into a wall so many times to suddenly be like, oh, woo. And then, so like those kind of highs are so addictive. And it's like sometimes like you must have the same when you're, especially at uni, you've got your headphones in, you're listening to music, you're doing work and you've done like 10 hours of work and it's just kind of, you just zoned out.
That's why I asked you earlier, what's your most productive time? Because still now, and I don't think it'll ever change, is not any hour in the day. It's probably about 10 till about 3 o'clock.
Yeah, 100%,
and I know that it's that when you start at 10, or for some reason you've just texted, you started to do something and you know that I know it's the most productive time ever because it's the only time of day where I don't look at the clock and think, oh Christ, I could get something to eat or something. I look at the clock and it's like, shit, it's 3 o'clock. I've got work tomorrow.
Yeah.
And you look back at how much you get done and you get really into it and really excited. Yeah. And that's when you start to do loads of bits and everything starts to come together.
I know, I totally
And then
agree,
you even look back at the work that you did the next day and it still stands up. It's still good.
But
that's my favorite time.
No, it
doesn't happen. I can't force it. If I start thinking, oh yeah, I worked till 3 o'clock tonight, it'll never happen.
I'm just so spectacularly easily distracted and I almost like stupidly surround myself. You know, you've got those double screens. Yeah, and you've got like your email literally taking up like one eyeball. And then like you've got your phone like buzzing all the time and you're listening to music. And like, so I try and turn off email now and not listen to music. Yeah. But again, suddenly, once I finally realized how to create a little Zen bubble for myself, suddenly people need help. Like you're one of three people that understands everything about the project. So people are like, well, what width's that? What size is this? What material? Like, what do I do? What are we doing for tomorrow? We've got a meeting, and you're like, okay, right now I go and do that. Okay, I'm gonna do that, and then you sit down. Right, okay, let's go. Let's do some work. Okay, the phone call's gone off, and then it's like, so yeah, I used to love. At uni, you don't understand how just the ability to focus on one thing is so good. Like I like in first, second, third year, you do like structures and services and all sorts of other modules and history of architecture and loads of other things, you know, like dip your toe in.
But is it just one building that you're, is it? Cause
no,
I know
you do like, you do two or three every year, maybe four different projects.
Can you say like, I don't know if it's not, but can you say how many buildings you're working on now, or is it just the one that you're working on?
I've only ever worked on one building at a time.
But there's people that will work on, or is that just the lead that will work, that will kind of work
if you, on if, a you, few? If you're on a, well, yeah, the project leads will, yeah, definitely.
They'll work on a few, different one and have different teams working on different.
It's almost like when, like one of the best feelings is
you
when.
You have an organized mind to work on a few different buildings, surely.
Yeah, definitely.
And trust in those different.
But teams. I would say in the same way that you work on a, you know, working on your book and working here and doing other things in your own spare time, and like it, that mindset just scales the more so you experience get. And it's like I was working on Broadgate, designing my mum's library, designing Scroobius Pips recording studio, trying to do a podcast, like, but all at the same time.
Oh,
but
that's cool.
That's where we're going to record something. Maybe. If you're still listening, that secret, don't tell anyone. I like multitasking, but at the same time, I just trying to sit down and do work. Do you know, I'm like a plane taking off. It just takes me a couple of hours to get into the zone. I'm there. Yeah. But like every now and again, you get grabbed.
Sometimes
back down
it can
to
be like a rocket. Like, come on.
So I love, especially like, I think for me doing CAD work, like just the way my mind works is like, the reason I didn't like revision is because you can revise all night and under stress it evaporates out your head.
Yeah.
Like I just can't.
But it proves no point. What is that doing an exact? It proves no point.
Yeah. Whereas when you're doing CAD work or graphics work, you know, you move a tech, it's there. You design a wall, it's there. Like, and the thing that I loved and I found quite addictive was the way that you can machine repeat geometry. You know, like, or like say you do a wall and then fan the next one out 1 degree, next one 1 degree, and suddenly you have this perfect curve of walls and like and structure and like, so like I love electricity pylons and stuff. Like I love the idea that that's the
someone that in the year below me I tutored on, well, helped I tutored him for once in his last year on a book that was all about pylons, that was kind of fun. But it was funny because he like explaining the story of him is almost explaining the story of what you've been through, because he had so much research and so many different like tests of different typefaces and God knows what throughout it. And I was like, looking forward to this, your first layouts are probably your best. And he, because I was with another tutor at the same time tutoring him, and he went back to that one thing, stripped it all back, started to put everything in, made this beautiful book on pylons.
Yeah.
It's essentially kind of like a boring, and he even knows it's like, you know, a boring subject, but made it beautiful. We're saying to him, look, you just got to make this book like a pornographic book on pylons.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Ended up doing it and won the New Designer Awards week at the New Designers thing as well.
Wicked.
That's also, yeah, it's awesome.
But it's like, I love the way they look, and I love the way they stand out in the like the landscape. They're such a like an aggressively angular.
Crazy concept ones.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. That one. I tried to enter that competition as well. The reason they like that one is like it was very unique. Like you're not going to see one like a curved one. Yeah. Mine was like it had like wind turbines in the middle, and you could move the electricity into the power
was
grid.
Was it you that was telling me about the ones in Iceland?
Yeah, they're like people literally walking.
I didn't see them.
I don't know if they've been built, but they were so evocative. But it's like
Have you been to Iceland?
No, I really want to go after your pictures. But I was like, the thing I was trying to say was I find, if you're hand drawing, you have to physically draw every single one.
Yeah.
Whereas you can draw one thing really, really complicated in the computer and then rip that 100 times. So like, but then like if you're driving down the motorway, you'll see a street pylon, like a street light, like a T-shaped street light in the middle of a motorway.
Yeah.
But one of them on their own is totally boring. But when you see like 500 of them snaking off into the distance and they're all exactly the same height off the road and you can see that it's like parallel with the ground. Yeah. It's like, it's amazing to see. And it's like, I'd say like, all of
you
my
pretty much like that is exactly the same as when if I'd gone off on one and talking about typefaces to a mate in a pub that's a builder.
Yeah.
Literally does not give a shit. He's like, why are you talking about the letter A and how beautiful that is, you idiot?
So you can imagine why at home in the Midlands, you just keep that shit to yourself. Do you remember Ben? Oi, pylon boy. Like, whereas here, they're like, you should make a book. You should like present a book on it. Whereas, back there, it's like, shut up. So it'll pretty much all of my work has these kind of elements of like repetition and like technical, because I guess like a little bit, like if you see a concrete box, you're like, I don't get it, it's a concrete box. But if you see like a Richard Rogers skyscraper, it's like, one, it's just like structurally mind-blowing that someone can build it.
Yeah.
Two, it's logical, you get it, like all the structures on the outside, you're like, that's how the structure works. And it's huge, and it's like perfectly proportioned. Like, you just get it.
Yeah.
But then, so I quite liked the whole, like, not majesty of it, but the scale of it is impressive, just from an engineering point of view. So a lot of my buildings would be, they would use engineering and like, you know, visible structure and stuff to like impress you, I guess.
Yeah.
Whereas I would always be a bit afraid to like, just do a very singular block. So I would go totally in the other direction, which is to be like, wow you with like structure and scale and complication and just like literally hit you with like 50 things. And it was only like through kind of, you know, like refining it that you start, like you kind of have to get to that point to then work backwards and strip it out. But that's the only way a simple building works, is for you to go right to the very complicated extreme, show that process and then show why you've pared it back. Like, I think that's why I failed so many times to do like an elegant building. Cause I was like, well, there you go. It's a box. Yeah. But you've just done a box. I'm like, that's like a Peter Zumthor book. That's a box. Mine's a box. And they're like, but he's got an entire book dedicated to that box. You've just done like 5 pages. And I was like, I don't understand. There's a box. So like, it was only after like going to the very extreme of one design and that I'm like, I get it now.
Yeah.
I get it.
But it's the Massimo Vignelli, Massimo Vignelli.
Yeah.
The quote that he comes, I always get it muddled up. It's like left and right, but complexity without simplicity and simplicity without, I can't remember which way. It's complexity. I can't remember.
I get what you mean though. Yeah. You need to have
but one complexity and simplicity in the right way around, or simplicity and complexity. Yeah.
But you know what's funny is I just said, I get it now.
Yeah.
But then like I go and talk to something
be very simple but yet complex.
But imagine the same way that I'm passionate about concrete and angles and like interactive sculptural architecture and like glass and high-tech steel. You talk to anyone in this office and they have a similar passion about some a totally different aspect of architecture.
Yeah.
So just when you think you've got it,
yeah,
they're like, no, have you seen this like subterranean architecture, the guy that only uses hay, or someone like I think it's Shigeru Ban, I can't remember how you pronounce his name, he builds everything out of cardboard, so cardboard structure, cardboard churches, cardboard everything, but uses tensile cardboard as a structural component, like a recyclable cardboard. And you're like, I know nothing again. Like, I want to do that. So like, eventually you just give up like trying to learn everything and just really focus in on the thing that you love.
Yeah.
Because if you just keep trying to chase the answer to something, you're never going to get there.
Yeah.
So for me, the podcast was the antithesis of that. It wasn't architecture, but then architects write books. They'd like Stuart Blair in office. This is incredible art, like watercolor paintings and stuff. And they're amazing. I thought there was an answer, you know, like I'm like my dad's an engineer, granddad's an engineer. There's got to be an answer to something.
Yeah.
And you're like, it's not. It's all personality. It's just a roaming seascape of personalities. And every building is a personality and a snapshot in time of fashion and personalities and budgets and economy. And there's a whole report about how tall buildings, when you get those super tall buildings, is normally a sign that's going to be an economic recession at some point. Because if it's cheaper to build 400-meter tower, then like if that's how much land is worth, it's financially viable to stick a £500 million skyscraper. Like that's how much that tiny plot of land, like 50 by 50 meter plot of land in London, you can put £500 million skyscraper on it. That maybe there's a little like there's something funny going on in the whole like economic. So like people have mapped out economic shifts with skyscrapers and like fashion with like you know, you look at fashion magazines,
yeah,
like, and they're all in buildings. They're all,
yeah.
Sometimes it's called busted architecture. Sometimes it's timber. Sometimes it's all plain white. So, like,
yeah,
it's a, like, in fashion's just the same. It all kind of, you just got to like just do the bit that you love. Focus on that bit and just keeps like picking away at that bit, and then like it reaps so many rewards. Like I like,
well, that's kind of what I like about what I do is yeah, that the raw materials is it's almost the reverse of that. That what one is kind of the reverse of that. Like you pick your tools, so you pick like the style. Maybe, well, maybe you won't, but like, say for instance, we'll use Massimo Vignelli for an easy one. Like he picked a group of typefaces that he'll always only ever use, because they're well designed. They're designed by people that are well respected, and they're solid. And then you kind of you have a very deep understanding of the grid system, and then you have a good knowledge of paper and printing and branding and all that kind of thing. So you know your tools and all that kind of thing. And then there's a whole wide scope of different companies that you or different things that you can work with. And it's that, and funnily enough, it's probably one of the only jobs or careers where you can go into somewhere and they'll tell you every single ounce of detail about their company. They'll tell you everything because you need to know it to rebrand their company or something like that. And it's the only, like, pretty much the only job that you can do that. You can go into somewhere and be like, right, tell me everything about your company. I want to know everything.
Yeah. Because you think, you know, it's like when you ask me, like, what is the CreateMore? Like, what is CreateMore to you? And it's like, well, let's get right down to the fundamentals of it. And you're like, you have to really think about it. And then I went away and I was like, is that what CreateMore is? I think it is.
You need to hurry up and tell me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. So I think, like, well, we're like, we smashed right past the 2.5 hour mark. So unless there's anything else you want to ask, I mean.
Why do architects only, why do them hate biros?
They're just shitty little biros, aren't they? I don't know, like, genuinely, if you draw, you draw in pencil, like a lightweight pencil.
But if there was a biro on your desk,
shit, it's crushing under my foot.
If there was a biro on your desk and you had a piece of paper and you had to draw something, would you go to the cupboard, which is out of your way, or use that biro that's on your desk?
Okay, honestly, I think it's because
use that biro, would you? You'd go and get a new one.
I hate the color blue.
No, but it's black. I want to know it's black. Blue.
Do you know what? Part of me thinks it's because it's such a fine metal point. It tracks anything on a table, and you get this scraggly little line, and like you have to hold it quite vertically. If you do it on its side, it doesn't write though. So like you get this like jabby little pencil, like a tattoo ink is that, and they like crush it. You just have a thin pencil, thin black pen, fat black pen. That's all you need. Or you have a Microsoft Surface and you have the world at your fingertips.
With a biro button on it.
With a biro button. No. Fucking biro. I don't know why biro. Yeah, architects are funny people.
It was funny seeing how quick it was, like a hot piece of coal when you used that biro on my desk. What's this?
Jesus. I think it's my handwriting's particularly bad anyway, and a biro really highlights. But
you're not the only one here. I know someone, an architect here, that does like a biro.
Yeah.
And he's on a table full of people that hate biros.
Well, having said that, Yiping, who I sit next to, she was, bearing in mind, I've taken a picture of it, it's that good. She was bored and just had like a pack of multicolored biros and did this amazing face, like just a drawing of a face. And I was like, oh, geez, I'm not worthy. Like it was amazing. It was genuinely a piece of art. And I was like, and you did that with a biro of the love of God, of all the tools to do it with.
You picked up a biro.
No.
Was there a blue one in there?
No. Yeah, probably. It's pink, blue, red. I don't know if she found that pack of biros. She probably bought it and spent hours doing it and traced it. Like, she probably just like, no, I just did it.
An architect bought a biro.
No, I don't think so.
Criminal.
Yeah. Well, that was good. Is there anything else?
All on architecture. All about yourself.
Yeah, there was loads of stuff. It's quite therapeutic actually talking about yourself, isn't it? It's interesting. I never really spoken about why I love the architecture I do.
And what you do.
Yeah. Well, it's because I still feel like I'm working that out. Like every time I think I know what I'm doing, you get moved up a position. Yeah. I guess it's like imposter syndrome, but I'm like, because the thing is, like when I worked in my first practice, Bailey Garner, like, my boss Marcus was very good. He used to run his own practice, but everyone else was kind of like, it was not like they weren't good. They just weren't passionate.
Yeah.
They didn't explain anything to me in an exciting way. It was just, why are we doing this? Because we have to, otherwise we get fired. That was basically the premise of their job. And that was it. I was telling you about setting out. And the guy there, instead of changing the setting out, just deleted the text off the setting out. So instead of saying it's 13 meters from grid to grid, he'd drawn it at 12.88 and just couldn't be bothered to change it. So just deleted the text and wrote 13 meters. Which meant that when they built the foundation off his drawing, they didn't measure it, they just went off the text. But every other drawing set on top of that actually had dimensions as done automatically by the program.
Oh, God.
So they built all the walls, and then it got to the foundations at the end, and it was like half a meter too short, that the whole end of the building was. So for 6 months, I literally just spent six Jesus. Months rearranging social housing flats to fit on... Bearing in mind these flats are already as legally small as you can make them. You had to, like, the stairwell had to get slightly thinner. And, oh, it was just, everyone hated it. It was just such a crap project. And I came away going, this is terrible. And then I worked at a company called Holloway Foo. And they're a really small design practice. They had a studio called In the All in the Detail, like a furniture arm. So like,
how long have you finished uni? How long are you out of uni now for that?
Well, I finished my part two like 5 years ago.
Oh, okay.
And
you've
they would
make about a year.
I've been a mate for like six years in August. And then...
So wait, how long ago did you finish?
So I finished like almost uni. 6 years. So 6 years in August, I'll have been at make and finish uni. I literally finished in June and came to make in August.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But coming here, like the Holloway Foo one, this guy was like a dad and he ran his own practice. There was two of them in there and me.
Yeah.
And they were like amazing. They were so fast at everything, but they were headphones in, get that work done. They didn't have time to chat because they were running. And they were like, he'd spend as much time getting money off clients as like just chasing them as doing design. Like he was on it from the second he got into the second level. There was no time to faff around and talk. And then at Make, everyone's so passionate. Yeah. So like, even if you're working on something you don't particularly believe like is that interesting, when you understand like the guys who are building it, what they need on site, like how much money, how much complication, how much time in, time out it's going to take, like what the knock-on effects, all these other things, it, you know, you can't help but kind of like, there are obviously ridiculously boring things you have to do on the project, but like anything amazing, there's going to be peaks and troughs on it as well. So like, but you know, like for example, on Broadgate, like I was doing the basement, like babysitting the basement, basically. Like the design was given to me and I had to just see it through to construction.
Oh dear.
And it was amazing to see it all being built, but I didn't design it. Looked after it. Whereas the roof I designed.
Yeah.
And the roof was like my baby then. But like being on site's hard in a basement, right? You're in a basement every day with builders and contractors. Like you come here and it says, we've got like a reception introduction. Like the receptionists take your coat, they look after you, get tea, coffee. You go on site and like, they hate you. You're an architect, they hate you.
Yeah.
But what was amazing, so like, as I said, peaks and troughs, like, but I could walk up. So at night, I brought my best friend, one of my best friends down from Liverpool, and he'd not been around these buildings before. So I got my hard hat, high vis on, and like at night, climbed all the way to the top of the building, and then they had the scaffolding around the cooling towers, which are 13 meters up. And he was like, you sure this is safe? And I'm like, I'm an architect, I know what I'm doing. And we went all the way to the top of the cooling tower, just me and him. And we had this like, Batman moment. Like we're the only two people within 100 meter radius, but literally beneath us, like 100 meters away or whatever, there's like thousands of people, like Liverpool Street Station. You can see the trains coming in, coming out. You can see like the gas, like the steam coming off all the cooling towers. Like you have the most incredible view over London. And we were the only people like for like 100 meters in every direction. But like you could see everything. And I was like, yeah, that was amazing. That was amazing. And then you go back down and you get yelled at by contractors again. So it's like... So there you go.
But I suppose what you've got to remember is that those people that are looking at you like, oh, flipping architect, is that for them to redo... Like for you to redo something on a drawing is like, oh, yeah, put that there, but it's a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
And I know it's more than that, but working on site...
Yeah.
If an architect changes something, it's like days. It can be days worth of work to change something. Even like for what I was doing was small scale.
Yeah.
Like if you're working on price, or like even if it's just day rate as well, it's because it was weird. I had to when I went to university, I had to quickly drum out the idea of what I learned at plumbing is to do one thing once, like, and do it well.
Yeah.
So you'd never have to do it again.
Yeah.
And in my first and bit of second year as graphic design, I would be constantly just being like, I'll do it once and do it well, and that's it. I don't have to touch it again. But with graphic design, you have to do it a million times.
And you lose total focus on what the hell's going on. Yeah, you know.
But to learn that that craft and like as and to be comfortable with that is a hard thing to break when you used to be so used to doing that. But yeah, like you say, like with all those people.
But it comes down to personality again. Like I find that the thing I struggle with is making a decision, because like in the back of my head, what would my boss do? Like, he'd do this. What would my old boss, Rob, who like was the most incredible mentor to me here, like what would he do? He'd do that.
But you know what? I find them decisions easier to make for my own stuff. Like stuff here, because they've got people to answer to, I find those decisions harder to make. But if it's my own stuff, I can I find it easier to have. I've got so much freedom then that I know that I have to make, that I have to come up with the decisions to give them to the person that's paying. And for some reason, I find it easier to answer those questions. But when I've got like other people to work with, even though I prefer working with people, I for some reason then fall on sometimes like. For them to answer the question a little bit.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? No. That's what I'm saying. That's exactly how I feel here as well. It's like, but you know, if you're working.
What would they do?
Huh? Yeah. Yeah. Well, exactly. But then as well, like, I kind of think whilst, you know, as an architect, you want full control over everything. Mm-hmm. Like, I am only in the position I am because of Make and because of Ken. Like, to think that I have any right to design a skyscraper over anyone else. Like, I think that's one of the hard things to get for people to get their head around is that, you know, is Make, you're like a swirling mass of design, right? Mm-hmm. So like, I don't think any one person, like, while, you know, Ken does a huge amount of the sketching and the conceptual stuff at the beginning, like, I think everyone has their own little, like, you have to kind of like say that everyone built it together, right? You know, like, yeah. So, I mean, so you don't really get that kind of sense of personal. That was me. That was definitely me. Everyone feels a little bit like, no, I worked on that at planning when it was like 5 years old. No, where's not you?
Yeah.
Like, I know I moved that line to that position like 5 years ago. You just built it. And like, everyone has their own little, like, their own little bit of like, their like right of the building, which is why the podcast is just my own thing.
Yeah.
I felt like, you know, that's kind of 100% mine, as in the idea and the way it's gone so far, and that's been incredibly satisfying. So now I feel comfortable that I want it to grow and, like, you know, like to do more stuff with it, because I feel like I've kind of proved myself now. But that's led on to that. So, like, again, I thought I'd find an answer in it, and I have, but it's opened 10 more doors, and I'm like, well, now I want to go through every one of those doors again. So it's like, if I just, like, sometimes whenever I, you know, question, is this the right thing to do? I'm like, well, would it interest me?
Yeah.
Well, then, yeah, do it.
Yeah.
Like, that was it. Like, Scroobius Piff interviewed this Ed Skrein, who's like the bad guy in Deadpool. And his mantra's like, fuck it, why not?
Yeah.
And I was like, brilliant. Yeah. Fuck it, why not? Yeah. Like, and I was like, yeah, you know what? Like, if you just, like, you know, give it 100%, which I now know.
Yeah.
But before it was like, maybe I will. No, I don't. No. Whereas now it's like, I'm going to do it. No, I'm gonna do it. But yeah, it's been it's good.
How long is it?
That's it's been 2 hours 46. And on that, thank you very much, Sam.
No problem at all. Thank you.
Longest one so far. Well, I'm gonna mix it up. I've got the one I'm releasing tonight with my mum.
Nice.
So that's literally an hour. Bang on. So yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, there you go. That was long, wasn't it? But thank you so much for listening. I've kind of listened back to that 2 or 3 times. That sounds really vain, but it's very weird listening to yourself talk about yourself. And it's like at the beginning, I'm very aware of it. And then within 5 minutes, I'm genuinely listening because I've kind of forgotten, you know, all the details that I talked about. And, you know, it's been like 2 or 3 weeks since we recorded it. So to kind of go back and listen to it was really good fun. I mean, I genuinely, if you get the opportunity to record it gets someone, I know it sounds weird, but like it, or me, come on the podcast, but to really talk about, you know, what you're passionate about. And I guess it's very weird putting myself out there and just being totally honest about all my massive failures along with the successes. I hope it was an even split. Feels like in life it's been an even split. Yeah, it's been really good. I really hope you enjoyed it. And it's kind of renewed my enthusiasm for architecture in a very weird way. Like, I realize it's one of the very few professions that holds my attention span. I think you can tell by the direction the podcast takes and the people that are on it. I just want to find out loads about everything. And, you know, I always question, like, is architecture the right thing for me? Like, what? How do you know? Like, it's... So maybe by the time this comes out, there'll be a public consultation on the skyscraper I'm working on in London. And if it does go ahead, it might be another 5 years of my life. I'm incredibly proud of that project. But it's like 5 years, though, on one project. And it's hard. It's incredibly hard and complicated. And it's, yeah, so I'm constantly kind of picking away, is this the right industry for me? Is this the right thing? You know, there's things that I love about architecture, things that drive me mental. So this podcast gives me the opportunity, but like, it's really funny listening back to the things that I really liked in part one, doing my part one, to the things that I like now haven't changed. And the architecture profession seems to be one of the few professions that no matter how much I pick away at it, there's always more stuff to find out. And I think it's because it's an industry based on personalities. And I think I find that fascinating enough to dedicate my entire life to it. I feel like, things like virtual reality and app design and all those types of things, I absolutely love that idea of that constant changing environment. But at the same time, will that industry exist in 10 years' time? Will you constantly have to move through industries? Whereas architecture really does feel like it stands the test of time in that respect. So yeah, thank you so much for listening. And over the next 2 or 3 months, how's this a little sneak peek? I may have got the contact, for an astronaut. How good would that be? And I have a movie poster designer. I have a comedy comedian. He's also a cage fighter. Amazing. I may get another famous person on who you will have heard in series one. Subscribe and support it and put a review on iTunes if you've enjoyed it. And thank you so much for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Bye-bye.